Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia and the Department of Slavic Languages and Literature, I'm delighted to welcome you all to this special Monday afternoon event. We're so pleased to have as our guest speaker today Mikhail Shishkin, Mikhail Pavlovich. And I wanted to acknowledge and thank Vladislav Vyazovsky for all of your help in making this visit possible. This is a real treat for us. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Jennifer Tischler. I'm the Associate Director of CRECA. And if this is your first visit to a CRECA event, I invite you to take one of our schedules. On the back table, there's also a sign-up sheet that's making the rounds if you'd like to be added to our mailing list or our email list. So just a little bit about the speaker, although I understand that we have several students here who have been reading the works of Mikhail Pavlovich in their class. Mikhail Shishkin studied at the Moscow State Pedagogical Institute, where he trained as a teacher of German. And following his graduation in 1982, Mr. Shishkin worked as a journalist at Ravesnik and then as a teacher of English and German. In 1995, he moved to Switzerland. And in the past several years, Mr. Shishkin has published three novels. Взятие Исмаила, The Seizure of Ishmael, won the 2000 Booker Prize, and Venerin Volos, Maiden Hair, won the National Bestseller Prize in 2005 and the Russian Big Book Prize in 2006. Besides his rich work in the literary sphere, Mr. Shishkin works in Switzerland as an interpreter. And in addition to his works in Russian, he also writes and has been published in German. And the topic of his conversation today is going to be contemporary Russian writers between the market and the last judgment. So please join me in welcoming Mikhail Shishkin.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Thank you very much for having invited me to Madison. Okay. When it creates reality, language becomes a judge. It can pronounce a death sentence or it can grant clemency. But when language condemns itself, there is no court of appeal. Even before the writer sits down to write, he already resembles Laocoon, strangled by the snakes of language. In order to explain anything at all, a writer needs to free himself from language. A lot of time had to pass after I moved from Pushkin Square in Moscow to Zurich before I could leave behind the strange feeling of unreality and exchange it for the feeling of meek trust. So everything is not an illusion. The trains are real. They are not toys. The landscape is not painted, and the people are not dressed up extras. After this change of scenery, I turned back to the novel that I had begun writing in Moscow, but nothing came out. The letters of the alphabet that I wrote at home had a completely different density abroad. My novel turned out to be about something wholly different. I stumbled over every word as if the words were steps too tall to climb. Frontiers, distances, even air do wonderful things to words. Russian sounds, so natural and inevitable in Moscow, are barred from entering another country by the border patrol. Deprived of their natural habitat, words become permanent residents. They become subjects of new domain and its laws. Any Russian word abroad has a different sound and a different meaning. As in the theater, where the meaning of a phrase changes when you change the scenery. A Russian word spilling out of a Russian ink pot weighs more once it has been imported into another country. Back in Russia, everything is spread across the heavens, falling in the rain, sprinkled on people's faces, or smeared across the Chechen war, and can be heard in phrases like Grushnitsky Junker, Grushnitsky was an officer, or Христос воскрес из мертвых, Christ has risen. Once abroad, however, what had been spread out is instead concentrated into one Cyrillic penned word, crammed and squeezed into its every letter. Even as Russia gradually disappears from reality, it seeks new vessels for its language and finds them in the whimsical outlines of its exotic alphabet. Russia has moved lock, stock, and barrel into its script. Like the communal apartments of the olden days, the letters are now expecting a wave of new arrivals. My departure from the Russian language, the fading of its buzz in my ear, made me stop and fall silent. When I meet writers from Russia, they express their surprise. How can you write in this boring Switzerland, they ask, without your native language, without Russian tension? They are right. Russian literature suffers from high blood pressure, and language changes very quickly in Russia. My departure from the Russian language turned me back to it. My work on texts has stopped. But this cessation is like a pause in music. Silence in music is part of music. Not writing is part of writing. What kind of language have I left behind? What did I take with me? Where will I go next? This was all the work of silence. In order to go further, I had to understand what the essence of writing in Russian is. Language is simultaneously the creator and the creature of Russian reality. It is the very mode of existence. It embodies a totalitarian consciousness. Everyday life manages without words. Instead, it is little more than animal noises, occasionally punctuated by expletives and quotes from familiar jokes and comedy shows. Only literature and political power need full sentences. Russian literature doesn't embody just the existence of language. It embodies the presence of non-totalitarian consciousness. Totalitarian consciousness, on the other hand, is fully satisfied with commands and prayers. Commands come from above, and prayers come from below. The latter are usually more original than the former. Curse words, mat, are the living prayers spoken in the imprisoned country. Commands and curses form the Russian yin and yang, the rain and the field, the penis and the vagina. This is the verbal conception of Russian civilization. Throughout generations, the prison reality of the Russian state gave its people a prisoner's mentality. Above all, its chief principle, the strongest gets the best bang. This consciousness found expression in language, which was called upon to serve Russian life by supporting its condition of constant and endless civil war. When everyone lives according to prison laws, language has only one task: to support the cold war of everyone against everyone. If the stronger necessarily beat the weaker, the task of the language was to do the same thing verbally: to insult, to humiliate, and to take away the weakling's ration. Language became the form of disrespect for an individual. Russian reality created a language with an unprecedented power to humiliate. The language used in the Kremlin and prison slang used on the streets share the same parents. Words violate, words murder. If the Russian border were closed, Russian literature would never have happened. Russian literary language entered the country in the 18th century, together with the idea of human dignity. Before that, there had been no words that could express respect for human beings. The first century of Russian literature consisted of translations and imitations. There was no language to express individual consciousness. This language had to be created. The Russians studied their literary language as if it were a foreign tongue. They had to introduce concepts that were absent in their language, like общественность, влюбленность, человечность, литература, society, infatuation, humanity, literature. Human dignity in Russia was embodied in the literary language, which managed to squeeze itself into the space between the insult and the groan. Words created a great Russian wall that stood between power and the people. Literature became a foreign body. It became a colony for European culture, built in the midst of the Russian fields. In this case, however, colonization did not entail importing German canon makers. Rather, it meant the refinement of Russian manners and the defense of the weak against the strong. As happens elsewhere, the colony has surpassed the mother country. And you here can understand what I mean. Turgenev, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Chekhov, all of them are colonists who, by means of their texts, transferred the literary capital from the old world to Russia. They took everything that was the best in Europe's millennium-old literary traditions and go east. But nothing runs harmoniously in the Russian kingdom. Once in a while, the power and the people reach each other and the colonists fall victim. The writer's bones crack, caught in the midst of the deadly embrace. The choice for them is to die or to slip out. In the 20th century, the indigenous population reverted to Russia's native literary process. Commands were handed down from on high, prayers rose up from below. Some colonists returned to their historic motherland, they immigrated. Those who remained in the Soviet Russia had their tongues cut out. The artificial language of the Soviet utopia was its very essence. The artificial and dead reality of socialism existed only in the correspondingly dead language of the newspapers, television, and party meetings. In the 90s, when the regime vanished, the language that had served it disappeared too. Prison slang rose to the surface and filled the gaps. Now, once again, the people and the political authorities speak the same language, and together they mochat Chechensov в сортире, the famous phrase by President Putin, the drowned Chechens in the toilet. The totalitarian mentality lives today in the language used on Russian television, where the main purpose of any dialogue is to out-scream the opponent. It lives in the nauseatingly yellowed newspapers. It lives in the streets, where the humiliating cursing mud is the norm. On the contrary, the language of Russian literature is an arc. It is an attempt to be saved. It is a line of defense. It is a small island where human dignity has to be preserved. When I left Russia, I lost the one language that I wanted to lose. The Russian language changes the way an animal sheds its fur. The fur is different, but the color remains all too familiar. In each generation, it reproduces itself anew. Russian literary language does not exist on its own. It has to be created in solitude every time anew. In the old Russia, the writer never depended on readers. Neither the writers who wrote for themselves and whose works were published by Samizdat and abroad, nor the others who received summer houses and bonuses from their Communist Party bosses. The Soviet government gave them a good living and published their works in mass quantity, or it threw them in jail and made possession of their works a crime. Either way, they were seen as heroes endowed with the wisdom to answer all the life's questions. The end of the Soviet era in the 80s and 90s opened new horizons for writers. Nobody cared what writers thought. The state ignored them, and people didn't read them. In the new capitalist environment, readers' time was consumed with a struggle for survive and earn money. Literary journals, literary magazines that were once devoured and discussed by every educated Russian barely hung on. The state stopped outlawing literature. The state stopped paying for literature. So literature was left to those who simply cannot live without writing. But then the dollar came. In the last 20 years, for the first time in the history of Russian writing, a literary market has appeared. At first, the market resembled a literary bazaar, a yard sale where all writers could sell their manuscripts to willing customers. Mammon began its energetic seduction of Russian writing. This market changed the meaning of literature in Russia. For generations, it used to be the sole bastion of human dignity. The poets wrote and repeated proudly, "A poet in Russia is more than just a poet." Then literature and writing became money-making enterprises. The book became a product, and the writer became a player in the business of book production and sales. The ready pattern, the ready model, came from the West. The consumer culture in the 90s brought a shift in values. The newly established mass consciousness considered everything that earned money as a virtue. A good book was a product that sold well. If a writer's work failed to sell, the writer was considered a loser without talent. The border between Soviet and contemporary Russian literature does not run across time, but rather along it. It traverses everyone who calls himself a writer. In the old days, writers either saved their souls and wrote without hope of money and publications, or else they consciously sold their souls to the devil and wrote what the regime demanded of them, and in return received prizes and decorations. Those talented people who tried to balance on the edge of what was allowed by the censorship, that is, to sell their souls just a little bit, in the end paid their talent. Now bestseller status tempts the writer's soul. Contemporary writers contemporary writers' dependence on the size of their print runs is no less destructive for real literature than depending on the regime's approval used to be. In order to enjoy the largest readership, writers must appeal to the broadest audience. People in Russia who write books and TV screenplays enter into a tacit agreement. The lower the bar, the more readers, viewers, and money they will have. As an example, consider one of the most successful books of recent years, Casual by Oksana Robsky. The publisher Rossmann started to publish the translations of England's Man Booker Prize winners and its shortlist laureates. The books didn't sell well. The owner of the publishing house stopped the whole project in spite of the fact that the rights for 20 books had been bought and translations had been paid for and partly finished. To reverse its money-losing streak, Rossmann invested in the promotion of Casual. Originally, it was a movie script written by an amateur, a young, beautiful widow of a rich new Russian. The story is set in Rublevka, the Moscow suburb where the new establishment has its luxurious villas. And it details the lives of the wealthy in their gated communities. Rossmann hired a team of ghostwriters to turn the script into a novel, and the book sold millions of copies. Oksana Robsky became famous overnight and even became a TV talk show host. The ascension of Oksana and her hacks over Booker Prize-winning authors signaled a new process of canonization. It is now the booksellers who decide what literature is. A completely new image of the successful writer established itself in Russia. If you want to succeed, you must follow at least three rules. First, you must write a lot, at least one big book each year. Second, you must appear everywhere, write in all newspapers and magazines, have your own radio program, and participate in all TV talk shows. Third, you must try to create as many scandals as possible. The poet and the czar. The relationship between intellectuals and the state, between author as moral judge and the regime, has been an important issue for all generations of Russian writers since Pushkin. Pushkin made his choice after execution and exile of his friends following the unfortunate December uprising 1825 in St. Petersburg. Taking into consideration that the government is the only European in Russia, and thus the only civilized structure which could oppose the bloody and appalling chaos which would consume the Russian people should the state become weak, Pushkin took the empire's side. He couldn't know how Russia would suffer due to the weak regency at the beginning of the 20th century, but he was aware of the lessons of Russian history. He wrote the history of the Pugachev peasant riot, anticipating the horror of the future Russian revolution and civil war. Nowadays, the state doesn't care for writers. The state does not need to care. The state controls the television. Criticism is still allowed in some newspapers, books, and the internet. But as the latest election results indicate, this criticism and that of the remaining independent media is insignificant. Newspapers, books, and other old media lost their popularity to the almighty television. The World Wide Web in Russia is still too young to have an impact. We now have a paradoxical situation in Russia. a totalitarian country with free literature. Many writers who are more than critical of the regime publish their books and sell well. The most famous representative of this writer's wing is Eduard Limonov, leader of the radical National Bolshevist Party, who tries to look like Trotsky. He was imprisoned by the new regime for some years because of his anti-government activities, but it doesn't prevent him from participating in official literary events. Recently, he headed the jury for the well-established National Bestseller Prize. The numerous Russian literary prizes became an important part of the literary life in recent years. The most prestigious of them are independent of the state, except for the recently established Big Book Prize. But even this prize rewards both the critical writers and emigre writers whose status in the new Russian Empire is again tantamount to betrayal. Alas, this acceptance of such threatening writers does not indicate liberalism or tolerance on the part of regime, but rather shows how marginal the role of literature in the new Russian society is. Sooner or later, the pendulum will swing back. After all, the Russian reader, educated, intelligent, searching, and acutely sensitive to the world's pain, is not going to disappear. He is still looking for a book that is his equal, a book whose author does not consider him an idiot looking for entertainment. It is insulting when a person is offered something beneath his level. It is time for books to reappear that will restore human dignity to Russian reader. I'm convinced that Russian writers must continue the tradition of writing as resistance to humiliation, as the way of preserving human dignity and non-totalitarian consciousness in Russia. And there are no prescriptions how to do this. Every author must find his way on his own, alone. I think I found mine. In order to build one's own Russian ark, one has to become a hermit. To do that, you first have to leave. It is not important where you are going to retreat, whether you go beyond the Alps or plunge into yourself. All that is necessary to take along is one's entire experience of love and loss, and 10 centuries worth of Cyrillic. In order to know the direction of the words, one needs 2 dots through which one can draw a line indicating movement. The first dot signifies everything that has been written in Russian before you, starting with the Slavic translation of the Bible. The second dot signifies you, with all your guts and the people you love. In order to say something new, you need to feel the centuries of tradition. Literary tradition is a living being. It is a plant. It is a tree. The juice flows along its trunk to the branches. The 19th century is the trunk of Russian literature. Then, in the 20th century, there was a divergence. There are some branches of absolute genius, like that of Platonov, for example. But this branch has been cut off. Nothing further can grow there. It is important to find the branch that grows upward, the very branch that grows towards the sky. For me, this branch is Chekhov, Bunin, Nabokov, Sasha Sokolov. In my texts, I wish to connect Western literature and its achievements in verbal technique with the humanity of the Russian pen. Joyce did not love his heroes, while Russian writers love theirs, A Russian hero is Akaki Akakievich from Code Gogol. The author loves him, although there is nothing to love him for. In order to understand the direction one must go, it is first necessary to turn back and to understand where one comes from. What is truly new always comes out of tradition. To understand tradition, one needs to understand the genetic code of the world. To find the lively spiral of the DNA, which can reveal the complex origins. If you keep unraveling the spiral, you will reach the one who awaits and loves us all. One simply needs to put the words together in that singular yet still unknown combination, so that the verbal chain will conduct life and culminate in God. The writer needs to find the verbal combination that has real blood under its skin. Words are the cobblestones of the longest and most important road. This road leads to the beginning of the beginnings. Quotation. At first, there was love. There was just a clump of love. It was not even love, but rather the need for it. Because there was no one yet to love. God was lonely and cold. So this love needed an outlet, an object, warmth, to press oneself towards someone dear, to smell the fragrant odor of a child's head, the child who is your own flesh and blood. And so God created his own child in order to love him. This child was Nineveh. A novel spells out the possibility to find the road that would lead to that very first love. The author is God for his characters. The reader identifies himself with the character. If the author loves Akaki Akakievich, who does not deserve to be loved, then the reader feels and knows that God exists and loves him, although he might not deserve it. He is loved as if he were a child. We need words in order to pave the road to this feeling. But any road needs repair. It develops potholes and cracks. The language becomes worn out. The road that has been used by generations becomes impassable. Language creates obstacles. Words that have lost their sacred meaning become a source of misunderstanding. They mean nothing anymore. One needs to do something with these hollow words in order to restore their divine meaning. One needs to build a new road. The run-of-the-mill novel uses worn-out language that leads nowhere. In order to reach the desired destination, one needs to build another road and to invent a new way of putting words together. For me, the only way to create my own language is to write incorrectly. I sniff every phrase, and if it is redolent of the manual, how to read and write correctly, I cross it. To say something correctly means to say nothing. After the Tower of Babel, language became the means of misunderstanding. Supposedly correct words that have given up the ghost can mean anything you want except the one thing you would like to say. These words evoke a feeling akin to the squeamishness one feels towards someone else's ragged toothbrush or towards a woman available for communal use. In the beginning, there was no word, only love. The child has not yet been conceived, but the mother already loves him. Later, when one body exists in another body. Love needs no words. After the child is born, the mother and the child still love each other subverbally. Only when words arrive on the scene do estrangement and verbal barriers begin to grow. Words are guards that do not allow meaning and emotion to enter. They police the borders between people. Either we need to understand each other by touch, or we need to break away beyond the verbal barbed wire fence. And still, the verbal way is the only path to understanding. We are policed by dead words. The only way to get past these dead guards is by making them live again. It is necessary to breathe life into them so that love can be called love again. Every new generation of living prose is just another path that leads to the same destination, where each of us is awaited and loved. The meaning of tradition lies in finding a new language and writing a new old novel about love, about God's eternal pity for Nineveh, and about the overcoming of death. In my novel, Maiden's Hair, there is a legend about a prisoner who was sentenced to solitary confinement for life. For years, he scratched an image of a boat on his wall with the tip of a spoon. Once, when the custodian brought him water, bread, and gruel, they found his cell empty and the wall clear. The prisoner had gotten into the etched boat and sailed away. A novel is a boat. One needs to make the words so vital that the boat can become real and one can live a life of solitary confinement for a place where all of us are loved and awaited, to be saved, and to take all the characters and the reader along. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
I hope you'll take some time for questions.
I'll be happy.
Questions in the audience, please.
Okay, to ask questions in English?
If it's difficult for me to answer or to understand questions, I hope you will help me. Yeah.
First of all, I'm all for love. I mean, that's nice. How do you now, in your individual situation, negotiate or think about the marketplace? How do you think about whether you have any readers at all or not, or how much do you care about that? And you have to be honest.
No, actually, it's the question of questions, yeah? I started to write when I was, I don't know, a child, yeah? I think a normal person, a grown-up, can't start writing because he's not crazy, yeah? Because he has the responsibility for the family, children, he must make money, and the way to make money through writing is the longest one, yeah, if any. So you can start writing only if your unconsciousness, yeah, as a child. And after that, it's already late, yeah? You can't stop. If you can, everybody will be happy. Your family will be happy. You can make everybody happy by stopping your writing, yeah? I tried, but I couldn't. I wrote my first novel. It was in the 80s, yeah? It was no possibility for me, and I knew that, to publish. And for me, it was already the tradition writing without hope to be published now and in this country, maybe later, maybe abroad, maybe after your death, it doesn't matter. Yeah? It was the whole long Russian tradition of writing without hope, but still writing. And for me it was okay. And then the possibility came to be published. My first novel was published in 1993 by the literary magazine Znamya. And actually I was so happy to as a young writer to be published, I didn't think of money. Yeah. And actually, for me, it was clear, I told myself, from the very beginning, after the market opened, yeah, the literary market came to Russia, I will never sell my words, my prose, my fiction. Yeah? And 95, I went to Switzerland. Actually, I'm a Russian writer, writing in Russian, believe me. I have Russian passport, but since 95, I live in Switzerland. It was not a political immigration. It was just family sake, because my second wife, Swiss. And I wrote my first important for me novel, Взятие Измаила, Taking of Ismail, in Zurich. And for me it was, I'm sure, very important to leave Russia, because I understood what is writing about, what is a word worth. In Russia it was for me more difficult, it would be more difficult to understand. Yeah. So just the fact that I lost this Russian, yeah, around me, helped me. Every writer has the choice. It doesn't matter in which country he lives, does he live in Russia or abroad, he has the choice. He tries to catch the today's language, today's slang, yeah, and work with this, and he could have success today. But nothing spoils so quickly as language. Yeah? And what is very new, very fine today, tomorrow it could be already like spoiled fish. Yeah. And so it's a risk for him that his success today, if any, yeah, will turn to disaster tomorrow. And there is another way to create such kind of language which will be fresh always after your death, because it will be your language. Yeah? And just my emigration, it was not emigration, but my emigration to Zurich, to Switzerland, just helped me to make my choice what to do. And when I worked on The Taking of Ismail, I was not sure anybody in Russia will publish it. I was not sure anybody will read it. Because I knew what I was doing. It was against the stream. The mainstream was to write as easy as possible. But I had to write in my way, no matter what was it difficult or what was it easy. And when Znamya told me, yeah, we will publish it, it was a great surprise for me. The second great surprise for me was the Booker Prize for The Taking of Ismail. I didn't expect it at all. And so, frankly speaking, yeah, I thought of a reader, but this reader was always behind me when I was writing in front of my computer. And when I like the word, I like the phrase, this reader claps me, it's great, I love it. And if I think it's bad. Yeah, I don't like this. And this reader tells me, delete. Why my books written in this way, yeah, thinking just about this reader behind me, why are they success in Russia? And they are success because now there are a lot of, I don't know, hundreds of literary prizes in Russia, yeah? But actually, there are three most important prizes for contemporary Russian literature. It is the Booker Prize, National Bestseller Prize, and this new established Big Book Prize. And I don't know why, I'm the only Russian writer who got all three prizes, but just for two novels. Yeah? How to explain it? I have one explanation. I think just there was a lagoon, yeah, a niche. Yeah, it was empty space. People were waiting for a book which will not humiliate them, but which will help them to grow. Yeah, to be better. And I think just my book, yeah, was such a book. So I'm happy, of course. I think this is the happiness of a writer when you see a reader. Today I was so happy when I said it was a surprise for me that students at this university read Maiden's Hair. And I was happily surprised. Yeah. Oh God, I have so I don't know 5 more readers.
6 maybe.
And of course, if I see that my books are sold, I'm happy. But the publishing house, which published my books, Vagros, yeah, just didn't pay. Yeah, so for me, the connection between the many sold copies and the money I got from it, it was no connection. Yeah, I'm happy that people could earn money selling my books, but the question is how to live, of course. If you don't sell, or if you don't make money with your books, no. Normally, one normal writer must produce one book a year. Yeah, for me it's difficult because I can write only one book in 5 years, and I earned my money in Switzerland since '95. Jennifer mentioned this. I worked as translator for refugees, and it gave me a lot of material, of course, for my book, The Venus Hair. But also because of the fact that I'm a well-known writer, I lost all my jobs because nobody wanted to have as an interpreter a well-known writer, because an interpreter must be just an heir, translating heir, piece of air. Yeah, and so I lost my jobs for private companies because it was good money just working as interpreter for some Russian guys coming to Zurich, going to the bank, opening an account. So, but who wants to open an account with a well-known writer? Yeah, and also I lost my job as interpreter for migration office, the Zurich Canton Migration Office, because they didn't want to have an interpreter who writes about the work of migration office. I can understand them completely. So since '95, I can't earn money as interpreter, and I think it's just because God's wanted me to go to Switzerland. I can survive, because in Switzerland, as in other, any other Western countries, if you enter the Writers' Union, you have the possibility to have some grants, fellowships, and so on. So, and writing, working on the next novel, and this year I finally started in January. I had a fellowship for 6 months in Berlin. It's a great city. I liked it very much. You see, when I came to Switzerland, it was a great feeling of new freedom, new possibilities. I felt myself like a very hungry cow on an Alp, yeah? A lot of fresh grass everywhere. And I could write there 4 books. But last couple of years, I feel like a hungry cow, but there is no fresh grass there, yeah? It's empty. Maybe just for a writer, it's always good to change continents, families, wives. And this, it's for young writers, maybe. Here are people here who want to become writers, just experience. And so this half a year I was in Berlin, and I could work fantastically. I wrote the half of the novel, and here now I'm in Lexington, Virginia, at Washington and Lee University this fall semester, and I hope I will finish this novel. So The Maiden's Hair was 2005. Next novel will be published in Moscow 2010, not by Vagris, by another publishing house. I hope I will earn a lot of money.
What are the print runs of your novel? How big are the print runs? Tirage
of all these books. I don't know. Because you see, they write only in Russia. They write in every book the tirage, 5,000, 7,000, and so on. And they publish all the time new editions. And you never know what is in reality. You never know. Because in you see, my books were translated into 10 or 11 or 12 languages, yeah? Both novels were translated into Chinese, into French, Italian, and so on. And it's normal that every year I get the papers, how many copies were sold, how many books were published, were printed. In Russia, you never know, because I never get these papers. When I'm in Moscow, I have to call these people and to ask for these papers. Okay, when for how long are you in Moscow? For 1 week? Okay, we'll do it. And they know, just they have to wait 1 week, and then I'm alone.
I want to ask what your conception of how the reader approaches the book, because you mentioned kind of two things. One is that, and this seems completely understandable to me, is the reader approaches the book looking for a challenge. The book shouldn't talk down to the reader. It's humiliating, and then that won't help the reader then grow. And the other idea is that the reader comes to the book for this sense of love, to be loved like a child. And to me, while those don't seem contradictory necessarily, they seem like they're heading in opposite directions, because one is there to challenge the reader. The reader enters into a dialogue with the book and creates something out of that. And the other, it would seem to be more patronizing. And so I'm just wondering how those two, challenging the reader or loving him like a child, either which one is more important, or else how they are the same, or are two sides of the same coin in your mind?
No, I don't write children literature. Yeah? For me, literature is not patronizing the reader, but not pampering the reader, but to go with this reader to a goal, yeah, to an aim. So what is literature for me? I'll try to explain. The first text, yeah, for me, the first novel, because I think that every generation of writers who don't think only on money, about money, yeah, but who wants to develop literature, to make something new in literature, they rewrite the same text. And rewriting the same text means they rewrite the text, the very first text, which was the prayer. And this prayer was the prayer, thank you, God, that you created this world, that you created this woman, that you created this child, that you created love, that you created death. And it was a divine text, because it was thanking God. But the problem is with the words, with the language. If you repeat the same words, they just disappear. They don't mean anything. So the new generation who wants to rewrite this prayer, the new generation has to rewrite this with new words, to find their new words. And they do it. For me, for example, Tolstoy, Anna Karenina, it's rewriting the same prayer with the means of the 19th century literature. And what I want to do is just to write the same prayer. Thank you that you created us, that you created our birth, our death, maybe resurrection. But I have to find new ways to rewrite this, find my words to rewrite this. Did I answer the question? No. I tried.
When you describe the kind of the creation of the literary language in Russia in the 18th century, you're using imagery of these writers you know, that form the you know, the canon of early Russian literature as colonists. Do you kind of conceptualize Russian literature as a transplant from Europe, or I mean, how is did it create itself in Russia, or is it does it come from somewhere else?
No, what I understand here under Russian literature and Russian literature language, I will try to explain it. Of course, there always have been books in Russia, yeah, since Christianity came. But for me, these books represent totalitarian consciousness. And another individual type of consciousness came only in the 18th century to Russia from the West. What I mean, yeah. And what happened in the beginning of the 20th century? What was the revolution? The totalitarian consciousness just overcame. Yeah, it was the victory of totalitarian consciousness on all levels. And the individual consciousness had to leave or to die. And, of course, there is always possibility for resurrection, yeah? And just you can save this non-totalitarian consciousness even in prison. Yeah, they can take everything from you, they can die you, but what is in your body, in your mind, it's your free, yeah, country, it's your territory. Yeah, and so this Russian literature, yeah, individual consciousness, non-totalitarian consciousness, survived in minds in Russia during all the years of Stalin era and abroad. And these two rivers of Russian literature in the Soviet Union and abroad, they came then in the 80s, 90s together. And now it is, actually there are no borders anymore, yeah? You can live in America, you can live in Africa, you can live in Moscow. If you write in Russian, you're a Russian writer.
You've talked about how the writer, the big writers, the Pushkins, the Dostoevskys, the Tolstoys, the Solzhenitsyns, they come out of either the branch of appeasing government authorities or going in defiance of government authorities. And now you have writers that are sort of submitting to the market forces, which is what makes, I guess what makes the writers what they are now. What will it take to make writers go from the submission to the market back to a higher greatness which would be akin to find when writing either in appeasement to or in defiance of a government or totalitarianism?
Sorry, I didn't understand the question. Could you repeat it in Russian shortly? So short. What's the essence of the question? Or could you?
I wish I still could.
Please help me, please.
Henrik, I'll try again in English.
Okay.
And then someone else will pick up on that from there. How does one? It seems like it's gone from greatness to a type of mediocrity. How did it go back from mediocrity to greatness?
No, if I understood you, so it's asking about how does a writer feel now, yeah? If it is in Russia, if it tries to sell himself, yeah? What is his attitude to the government in this direction, yeah? Да, пожалуйста.
Величие определялось из отношений его с властями, с властью того или иного рода, то теперь писатель, подверженный рыночным силам, попал во власть рынка, и поэтому, так сказать, литература в целом стала литературой посредственности.
Uh-huh.
Как быть дальше, как снова найти путь?
Uh-huh.
От посредственности во власти рынка обратно к прежнему величию, или к новому величию.
Okay, I don't think a writer who is really great has the goal to be great. Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think Solzhenitsyn, for me, he's a great. That the only thing he wanted to be great Solzhenitsyn. I can't believe Pushkin, Tolstoy. For them, it didn't matter at all the greatness. Yeah, I think to be a great writer, it's more for not great writer. Yeah, and. Maybe it's time to tell some stories with real names, yeah, of Russian writers, how it works now, for example, yeah, because it's theory and now it's the practice. In Russia, the main problem of writers is they depend on the Kremlin, they depend on the government, they depend on the political situation now, yeah. And if you want to be invited to some book fairs, yeah, you must have good connections. You must not spoil, yeah, your connection to the government. And such writers as, for example, Limonov, they spoil it, yeah? But nobody knows, is it marketing? I think it's more marketing in this case, yeah? But every writer, once have a choice, yeah, how to behave himself. Will the writer give the hand and shake hands with President Putin or not, for example, yeah? And you never know when it happens. For example, 2005, the book fair in Paris. Russia was invited as a guest country. And there were about 30, 40 Russian writers invited. And President Putin, at that time he was president, he came to Paris, and every writer in his hotel room, it was a five-star hotel in Paris, because it was everything paid by the Soviet government. Oh, by the, sorry. you understand what I mean. And every writer become an invitation, personal invitation. President Putin is inviting you to Елисейский дворец, Палец-Элизе, for a meeting, and there will be also President Chirac there, and it's the moment of truth, yeah? You can decide, do you go or not? No, for me, for example, it was clear, I don't go. Yeah, of course, it's interesting to see how the president of France and Palais-Elysée lives, it's interesting. But then I will have to shake hands with Putin. I can't. So for me it was clear, I won't go. And after that, I came to know who didn't go. Yeah, Люся Улицкая didn't go, for example. Yeah, Vladimir Sharov didn't go. David Markes didn't go. But people who are interested in publicity, in money, in books, like Viktor Yerofeyev, of course they went, yeah? And Viktor Yerofeyev was, of course, the first to sign his book to both presidents. And it's their choice. But I want to tell you the story I was told by David Markes. And it's a very sad story for me. It could sound funny, but it's a very sad story. Maybe you know Valery Popov. I personally liked him very much because he was a dissident. He participated in Metropol. Yeah.
Евгений Попов.
Валерий.
Ленинградский.
Да. Okay. And David Markes told me, David Markes was standing at the hotel in the lobby, and all writers were already in the bus. And then the organizer asked them, does everybody have the passport? Because it will be checked, yeah, in the palace. And Valery Popov said, oh, I forgot my passport. And please wait for me. And he ran to his hotel room. And they couldn't wait, so they left. And Markes says, Valery Popov comes down, where are they? Mark says, yeah, just left. And Valery Popov runs, and he doesn't see the door, the glass door. And everybody is shocked. His face is covered with blood. The door's opening. And with the Russian passport, he runs with the blood-covered face after this bus. For me, it was very symbolic. Yeah, it's a very sad story. About the relationship between the intellectuals in Russia and the Kremlin. Because intellectuals, all generations, repeat the same. Like a night butterfly, they fly on the Kremlin, on the power, as to the candle. You see, they can't stop flying to the candle. I'm not telling the story to show, oh, I'm good, yeah, and they are so bad, because they live there in Russia. When I come to Moscow and I am interviewed every time a lot, and they ask some provocative questions, I say what I think. One interview was entitled "В России государство главный бандит." Yeah, in Russia, the state is the main criminal. Yeah. But then, after giving this interview, I go back to Switzerland, and people who live there, they stay here, and I can understand why now they don't have any censorship at all. But the censorship is inside of all writing people. The censorship is inside of all people making television, making news, writing for newspapers. And I can't blame them. I don't have any moral right to blame them. I don't know how would I behave myself in their situation. I'm just telling you this, sharing my experience. Maybe it will be interesting for you, and it will help you to understand the situation in Russia.
Time for one or two more questions, and maybe there's a question waiting to be asked in Russia.
Спасибо.
Можете ли вы назвать несколько современных российских писателей, кого бы вы рекомендовали почитать молодежи, знающей, ну, хоть немножко русский язык?
Да. Спасибо большое за такой вопрос. Я такой вопрос очень люблю и всегда отвечаю с большой радостью. По-русски отвечать или по-английски? По-русски.
По-русски.
Хорошо. Дело в том, что писателей очень много. И проследить, отследить, что печатается, невозможно в принципе. Поэтому... Я уже давно перестал вот следить, как я раньше следил, просматривать все, что публикуется, это невозможно. Я думаю, все так или иначе имеют своих какую-то реферативную, репрезентативную группу, да, которым они доверяют. И если тот или тот человек сказал мне, читай это, вот тогда я буду читать. И со своей стороны я всегда рад, когда я могу посоветовать каких-то авторов. За последние годы... Были несколько авторов, которые, вот, например, мне очень понравились. Это совершенно не значит, что они понравятся вам. Да? Но я с радостью скажу о них. Ну, с литературой и советами, и вкусами это всегда проблематично. Это все равно как... Ну вот человек искал всю жизнь себе жену. И вот он нашел невесту. И он любит ее. Да? А я приду и скажу, что ты на этой идиотке женился. Да? Значит, если человек нашел какую-то книжку, полюбил ее, она ему нравится, так вот они нашли друг друга, и хорошо. Да? Значит, из авторов, вот иногда бывает, что автор напишет какой-то роман потрясающий, следующий уже я не могу рекомендовать. Вот есть такой автор Олег Юрьев, он живет в Германии. Он написал прекрасный роман, удивительный, необычный, называется «Полуостров Жидятин». «Полуостров Жидятин». Может быть, кто-то читал здесь. «Полуостров Жидятин», Олег Юрьев. Есть автор уже давно известный, и он все время пишет, но тоже о нем мало известно. Да, странно, известный, но о нем мало известно. Владимир Шаров. Его нужно обязательно читать роман «Репетиции». Шаров, Владимир Шаров, «Репетиции». Прекрасную книжку написала Майя Кучерская. Называется «Современный Потерик». «Современный Потерик». «Потерик». Это удивительная книжка. Вроде бы она издевательская. Это смесь Хармса и... Я же не знаю кого. Это про современную церковь. Маяку-Черская. Но опять, у каждого автора, которого я называю, много разных книг, но я отвечаю за те книги, которые именно я указываю. Прекрасный автор Дмитрий Рогозин. Но вот есть политик Дмитрий Рогозин, а автору не повезло, он тоже Дмитрий Рогозин. И политик Дмитрий Рогозин тоже книжку написал. Поэтому, когда я советую почитать Дмитрия Рогозина, пожалуйста, не перепутайте. Значит, у него, у Дмитрия Рогозина вышла в «Знамени» и отдельно в НЛО книжка. Прекрасная повесть называется «Поле боя». Она есть в интернете, в «Знамени», в журнальном зале. Дмитрий Рогозин, «Поле боя». Новый очень интересный автор, который развивается в лучшую сторону, это Захар Прилепин. Первые его вещи я не могу читать, не могу советовать. Но вот последний сборник рассказов с ужасным названием «Ботинки, полные горячей водки». Это про Прилепина нужно особо сказать. Это человек, который прошел чеченскую войну наемником. То есть он там добровольно был, зарабатывал деньги. Он написал про это книжку «Патологии». Он член партии национал-большевиков Эдуарда Лимонова. Он сам из Нижнего Новгорода. Но все вот это политическое, да, все, я уже по ранним книжкам чувствовал, оно куда-то уйдет, потому что у него очень большой талант. Вот в тех книжках политических потрясающие сцены описания любви. Если человек может написать что-то, хорошо писать любовь, значит, он будет, он изменится, он рано или поздно освободится от всего ненужного и останется только нужное. Вот в последние двух книгах, сборниках рассказов «Грех» и «Ботинки, полные горячей водки», вот это произошло. Самая лучшая у него последняя книга называется «Ботинки, полные горячей водки». Это просто сборник рассказов о счастье, о счастливых людях. Очень просто написано и очень глубоко. Ну, наверное, много еще, да?
Еще вопрос?
Почему какому-то автору обязательно жить за границей, чтобы писать о России, а кому-то нет?
Хороший вопрос. Ну, наверное, потому что люди разные. А ты же не можешь выбрать, где тебе жить. У тебя есть судьба. Да? Вот почему я оказался в Швейцарии? Я никогда в жизни не думал, что когда-нибудь окажусь в Швейцарии. Я не знал, где эта Швейцария находится, но вот я знал, что она где-то есть в русском сознании, да, вот есть такое место, какой-то рай на земле, где все умирают от скуки. Да, вот что я, собственно, знал о Швейцарии. Но боги так распорядились, что я влюбился в швейцарку, она влюбилась в меня. Да? Значит, у нас нет возможности решить, где мы окажемся. Вот ты оказался в Америке, здесь и сейчас. Мог оказаться в Африке, где угодно. Да? На этот вопрос нет ответа. Это вот как вопрос, кто я. Да? На этот вопрос не может быть ответа. Можно только быть ответом. Понимаешь?
Все от судьбы.
Я просто так думаю.
От Бога.
Я думаю, что... Для писателя, что бы с ним ни происходило, где бы он ни оказался, в американском университете, в русской тюрьме, на Колыме, просто семейная жизнь, просто у него жена, да, без тюрьмы, все это его капитал. Все это его капитал, и всего этого достаточно, и семейной жизни, без всякой тюрьмы, и войны достаточно для того, чтобы написать гениальный роман. И вот из этого капитала, что ты с ним сделаешь, в какой стране ты окажешься, это не важно.
Этим закончим.